Chapter 1. The List. Laurent. Sandrine and I had been drawn to Berlin with a kind of opportunity you get maybe once in a lifetime in journalism. A shot to break a story that could have serious implications around the world. It felt kind of fitting that our taxi from the airport to the city center skirted within a few kilometers of the Stasi Museum, a complex that once housed the apparatus of the East German secret police, the sword and shield of the state. This investigation, if we decided to undertake it, would have to contend with swords and shields wielded by a dozen or more very defensive state actors and by a $1 billion private technology corporation operating under the protection of its very own powerful national government. The taxi ride was the last leg of a trip that seemed to portend a rise of obstacles. The limitations put in place during the latest wave of COVID-19 had laid waste to familiar routines. The simple 2-hour trip from Paris to Berlin had taken triple that, and included a connection through the food desert of an airport in Frankfurt, and the indignity of German soldiers shoving cotton swabs up our nasal cavities before we were allowed to exit the airport in Berlin. By the time Sandrine and I stumbled into our sleekly modern and well-lighted little rented flat above Danziger Strasse, we were both so knackered that dark-of-the-night questions were already preying on us. Was this really the best time to dive into another difficult and all-consuming investigation? Our 9-person team at Forbidden Stories was deep into its 3rd major project in just 3 years. The current investigation, the Cartel Project, was already shaping up as the most dangerous we had done to date. And we still had a lot of work to do to be ready for publication. We were developing leads on the most murderous drug gangs in Veracruz and Sinaloa and Guerrero, on the chemicals needed to produce the supercharged opioid fentanyl, which were being trafficked into the country from Asia, and on the lucrative gun trade filling the cartel's private armories, as well as the bank accounts of gun manufacturers and private gun runners in Europe, Israel, and the United States. We were essentially picking up reporting threads left unfinished by a handful of brave Mexican journalists who had been killed, most likely by assassins from the local drug cartels whose violent and criminal activities the reporters had been investigating. Outside of active war zones, Mexico was, and remains to this day, the most dangerous place in the world to be a journalist committed to telling the truth about bad guys. More than 120 journalists and media staffers had been killed in Mexico in the first 2 decades of the 21st century. Another score or so had simply disappeared without a trace. This meant the Cartel Project tied seamlessly to the mission of Forbidden Stories. We aim to put bad actors and repugnant governments on notice that killing the messenger will not kill the message. Which means collaboration is an indispensable tool. There is strength and safety in numbers. The more journalists who are working the story, the more certain it is to see print. We had begun inviting into the Cartel Project reporters from our trusted media partners, including Le Monde in Paris, The Guardian in London, and Die Zeit and Süddeutsche Zeitung in Germany. The team would eventually grow to more than 60 reporters from 25 different media outlets in 18 countries. But the beating heart of the project already was Jorge Carrasco, who was the director of the most intrepid investigative publication in Mexico, the weekly magazine Proceso. A stubborn and celebrated reporter himself, Jorge was also a colleague and an exact contemporary of the woman who was emerging as a figure at the center of our investigation, Regina Martinez. Carrasco was still a reporter at Proceso in April 2012 when the news reached him that his co-worker had been beaten and strangled to death in her home. Regina had been a journalist for nearly a quarter century by then and had spent much of the previous 4 years dogging the powerful and dangerous drug cartel that had essentially taken over Veracruz. Cash was flowing into the region, along with waves of violence that convulsed the state's teeming port city and spread into the surrounding area. A large portion of Martinez's final reporting was in uncovering the destabilizing relationships growing up between local politicians, local law enforcement, and local drug lords. She hadn't really gone looking for the story, but if you were a sentient being in Veracruz in those years, it was hard to miss. And once she was on it, Regina had a hard time backing off even after she knew she was on perilous ground. She had confided to her closest friends just a few months before her death that she might have gone too far, and she feared for her safety. She was worried enough to stop using a byline on the most incendiary of her stories, but she refused to quit reporting. A few weeks before she was found strangled to death, Regina had published a damning report detailing the personal assets amassed by two public officials who had allied themselves with the Los Zetas cartel in Veracruz. 3,000 copies of that issue of Proceso were removed from the kiosk shelves before they ever made it into the hands of local readers. At the time of her murder, she was in the middle of investigating the story of the thousands of people who had mysteriously disappeared from Veracruz in the previous few months. Her death marked a before and after for the profession, one of Martinez's friends and colleagues would tell us. She was a part of a major national magazine. We thought she was protected. Jorge had already traveled to our offices in Paris to brief the Forbidden Stories team and our early partners on the state of investigative reporting in Mexico and the outlines of the Regina Martinez story. The 56-year-old journalist spoke with a soft, measured cadence befitting a classics scholar. But his message to us was sharp and compelling. Regina's murder was a point of no return, Jorge had explained. A very clear message that the cartels could continue to kill journalists and nothing happens. The police and prosecutors in Veracruz, Jorge told us, basically punted Regina's case in 2012, pinning her murder on a low-rent criminal who quickly recanted his confession, which the suspect claimed he made only after hours of physical torture by local police. For most of the 8 years since, Jorge had been determined to get to the bottom of Regina's killing. He had taken to heart the admonition of Julio Scherer Garcia, the founding editor of Proceso and the godfather of investigative journalism in Mexico. The world has hardened, and I think journalism will have to harden, Scherer said not long before he died in 2015. If the rivers turn red and the valleys fill with corpses, journalism will have to tell that story with images and words. Heavy tasks await us. Jorge Carrasco worked the story for years in spite of threats and intimidation, and even after the murder of a second Proceso contributor, who also demanded answers from the government about Martinez, but with little success. By January 2020, when Sandrine and I first visited the Mexico City offices of Proceso, offices with a security protocol you might expect at a bunkered police station, with a guard at the front gate and bars on every window, Jorge's ardor had cooled. He admitted to us that they had discussed it in the newsroom, as a staff, and decided chasing the truth about Regina Martinez's murder was too dangerous. If they kept it up, others were likely to die at the hands of the local drug lords. Once he learned an international consortium of journalists was willing to take up the story, though, Jorge seemed re-energized. He had dispatched his chief archivist to dig up all of Regina's stories from Proceso in the years before her death, and he asked us to loop another of his reporters into the top-secret signal group used by key members of the cartel project. But the last Sandrine had heard from Jorge on the Signal app, not long before our trip to Berlin, he had sounded a little shaky, lamenting the ongoing damage done by COVID-19 to his magazine's already slim and always wobbly profit margin. "I'm okay but worried," he wrote. "Sales of Proceso are really falling." I was keyed up when the buzzer to our East Berlin flat rang the next morning. We hadn't yet mastered the electronic entry system to our short-term rental, so I raced down the stairs and opened the front door for our two guests. The first I saw was a pale, wraith-like 30-something man with wire-rimmed glasses and a ski cap pulled tight atop his skull. He looked like the kind of guy who spent a lot of time indoors at a computer screen. I welcomed him with a cheery hello and stuck my hand out in greeting. "Claudio Guarnieri, senior technologist at Amnesty International's security lab," didn't offer any pleasantries in response, didn't shake my hand, didn't even really pause long enough to make eye contact. He simply bade me to direct him and the skinny young fellow with him up the stairs and into our flat, where we could get down to business at the dining room table. But there would be no business, Claudio explained, until we all powered down our phones and our laptops, put them in the next room, and closed the door on them. The cloak and dagger aspect of these instructions was not entirely unexpected given the reason for this meeting, but I was surprised by Claudio's brusque tone. He was polite enough, but not long on social niceties. In fact, he didn't seem to be much concerned whether we liked him or not. This was an alliance de circonstance, after all, and compatibility mattered a lot less than viability. We hastily stowed our electronic devices in the next room, but not before I took note of the sticker on Claudio's own laptop, a quote from the Mexican political dissident, Subcomandante Marcos. "We are sorry for the inconvenience, but this is a revolution." Back at the table, Claudio waved away any attempt at small talk and turned immediately to the reason we were all there. We had been chosen, Forbidden Stories, and Amnesty International's security lab, as the only two groups with access to a document we had taken to calling the list. Sandrine and I had each been given to understand that the data might help us uncover the existence of a system of truly insidious surveillance, made possible by a private for-profit corporation that touched thousands of unsuspecting individuals on almost every continent. They were a long way from proving that. We all knew at our table in Berlin that morning. The data in this list was a bit of a cipher, a scroll of tens of thousands of phone numbers from all over the world, as well as some timestamps. Only a handful of those numbers had been matched to actual names or identities. What we did know was that each number represented a person whose cell phone had been selected for potential infection with the most potent cyber surveillance weapon on the market, a malware called Pegasus, which had been developed, marketed, and supplied to law enforcement and national security agencies in more than 40 countries around the world by the alpha dog in the burgeoning industry, the Israeli tech company, NSO. Pegasus was coveted by national security specialists around the globe because it was regarded as state-of-the-art spyware. If a country wanted to catch the bad guys in criminal or terrorist acts, or to prevent those acts before they happened, Pegasus was a godsend. Each successful infection allowed its operator, or end user, to essentially take over a cell phone. Law enforcement or national security agencies would have access to every jot and tittle on that phone, before any outgoing communication was encrypted and after any incoming communication was decrypted. The operators of Pegasus could track that cell phone's geolocation and exfiltrate email messages, text messages, data, photographs, and videos. Pegasus also allowed its users to gain control of the device's microphones and cameras. Those recording apps could be turned on remotely at will, at the pleasure and convenience of the end user. The dangerous hitch in the Pegasus system was that it had not been limited to spying on bad guys. By the time we sat down in Berlin with Claudio and his number two, Danica O'Carroll, a few dozen cases of misuse had already been documented. Cybersecurity experts at the University of Toronto's Citizen Lab and at Claudio's Amnesty International Security Lab had found cases of Pegasus being used to target human rights defenders, lawyers, and journalists. The specialists in those forensic labs had not only elucidated many of the mechanics and capabilities of Pegasus, but had called out some of its most pernicious end users. WhatsApp had filed suit against NSO, claiming 1,400 of its users had been surreptitiously targeted by Pegasus in just 1 2-week period. Amnesty International had a pending suit also. The public domain was filling with information gleaned from legal filings in courts from the United States to France to Israel to Canada. There had also been some really good journalism and a growing body of scholarship on the rise of the for-profit intrusion as a service industry in general, and NSO in particular. These multiple investigations taken together were starting to look like a more successful edition of the blind men and the elephant parable. The combination of cybersecurity experts, academics, journalists, and justice-seeking victims working separately and in concert had managed to sketch a pretty complete picture of the cyber surveillance elephant at work. The outlines alone made crystal clear the threats to human rights and privacy, and yet even the most dismaying headlines and the most granular forensic analyses had had little to no real impact. Outside of calls from Amnesty International and Citizen Lab and the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Promotion and Protection of the Right to Freedom of Opinion and Expression, there was virtually no public outcry and very little actual attention. No governing body of consequence was putting any fetters on the industry. NSO's profits and its client base were growing faster than ever, with customers across Europe, North America, the Middle East, and Africa. The few of us invested in these issues warned again and again how the commodification of surveillance was paving the way to systemic abuse, Claudio would later say, reflecting on a decade's worth of consistent effort and consistent frustration. Very few listened. Most were just indifferent. Every new report, every new case, felt so inconsequential that I started questioning whether insisting on them was serving anything other than our own egos. That's what made this leak so enticing. Claudio never grew particularly animated our first day together in Berlin, or any other day thereafter. He was always careful not to betray any outward sense of excitement. But he clearly held hope that this leaked list might finally help him get the goods on NSO and allow us to draw the sort of public attention this unfolding crisis truly deserved. Claudio and Danica were slightly ahead of us in their understanding of the list itself, partly because of the technical skills they had developed over the last decade, and partly because the security lab had access to digital tools that forbidden stories lacked. Claudio set the agenda for much of that first day at the dining room table in Berlin, sitting on a sleek wooden bench, explaining the big picture of this story as he apprehended it at that moment. Timestamps and the data went back almost 5 years and extended right up to the past few weeks, Claudio explained, which meant the attacks were fresh and possibly even ongoing. We were likely to be investigating a crime in progress. He and Danica had already started the laborious process of identifying exactly who was attempting to spy on whom, and exactly when, and exactly where. The list of phone numbers was arranged in clusters, suggesting which of NSO's many client countries was targeting any specific individual. The government's selecting targets ranged from murderous dictatorships to would-be autocracies to the largest democracy on the planet. The most active client state by far was Mexico, with more than 15,000 separate numbers selected for possible targeting. The list no doubt contained hundreds of cell phone numbers of authentic drug lords, terrorists, criminals, and national security threats, the sort of malefactors NSO spokespeople claimed Pegasus was designed to thwart. But what Claudio and Danica had already learned about the range of targets selected for attack was eye-popping. When the two had started the process of identifying some of the phone numbers on the list, Claudio explained to us, it turned out that many belonged to academics, human rights defenders, political dissidents, government officials, diplomats, businessmen, and high-ranking military officers. Claudio and Danica had already found hundreds of non-criminal, non-terrorist targets selected for possible Pegasus infection, and they had barely scratched the surface. The group with the largest number of targets on its collective back, well over 120 and counting, was journalists. If the data in this list led us to the hard evidence necessary for publication, we all understood we would not only be able to reconfirm the already known fact that cyber intrusion and cyber surveillance were being weaponized to stifle the free press and to undermine and intimidate political dissent. We would be able to reveal that it was being weaponized at a sweep and scale that astounds and horrifies. As Claudio, Danica, Sandrine, and I scrolled down through page after page after page of possibly compromised cell phone numbers, it occurred to me that we were not merely groping around to help define the outlines of a single rogue elephant. We were looking at a herd of hundreds, thousands, maybe even tens of thousands of elephants thundering unimpeded across the plains, prodded by some of the most vicious political regimes on the planet, and headed right for cherished and necessary pillars of civil society. The large-scale, unchecked, systemic abuse of cyber surveillance weapons was a clear and present danger to the most basic human rights, including privacy, political dissent, freedom of expression, and freedom of the press. It was a threat to democracy itself, at a time when the world's most stable democracies were under relentless attack from without and from within. The first look at the list was slightly disorienting. The pull was magnetic, almost like a physical sensation. I reminded myself to take a deep breath occasionally as Claudio kept talking, noting, for instance, that it looked like Moroccan intelligence had targeted an extraordinary number of French cell phones. I had to tell myself not to let my imagination get too far ahead of me. Skepticism is crucial for any reporter. A stopgap to embarrassing mistakes, like being played by an unscrupulous source with an axe to grind. Or letting excitement about a potentially big story outrun good sense and rigorous vetting. Vetting the data in this list would take months. Finding victims who are willing to allow us to analyze their phones for evidence of Pegasus targeting, and to keep quiet about it while we develop the story, would be a delicate operation. Claudio and Danica faced a more daunting task, even with potentially compromised phones in hand to analyze. NSO had designed Pegasus as more than a Trojan horse. It was engineered to be an invisible Trojan horse. Top-shelf cyber surveillance exploits aimed to leave behind no detectable traces, and NSO was believed to be the best in the business at covering its tracks. Gathering unassailable forensic evidence was going to be an uphill battle, and forensics was only half the battle. Claudio, Danica, Sandrine, and I were talking about embarking on an investigation of a private company whose entire reason for being is digital surveillance. A company that trumpeted its ability to find anyone, anywhere. Considering that foreign governments on five continents had been paying NSO as much as $250 million a year to do just that, the company's spyware system was probably very good at it. The four of us understood what we would be stepping into by the time our first meeting came to a close. Claudio, most of all. He issued Sandrine and me another brusque set of instructions before we parted. He told us we needed to go out and buy new devices, no SIM cards, dedicated solely to communicating with one another. There would be no cell phone calls among the four of us or anybody else who came on to the project. No iMessages, no Signal messages, no WhatsApp calls. We had already, at Claudio's insistence, bought new dedicated laptops, PCs, not Macs, so that we could keep a hard wall between the Pegasus project and all the other work we were doing. If we went ahead with this project, it occurred to me, the main driver of the operation would be paranoia. When Claudio and Danica left that evening, after we had set a time to meet again the next day, the difficulties of tackling this investigation were already spinning in my head. The list itself was a big unknown. We had plenty of faith in the source of the leak, but that was beside the point. We were looking at months of authenticating the data on the list, double-checking every fact and story that hove up out of those tens of thousands of phone numbers. We were going to have to do this work while attempting to live within the physical and social restrictions imposed on us by the most lethal global health pandemic in a century. I was also having a hard time imagining forming a comfortable working relationship with Claudio, who had not shown even a hint of a smile that first day. Danica was much more open and easygoing, but the 27-year-old cyber researcher, as we later learned, also had good reason to be wary of reporters. Add to that, this investigation would have to be done within a bubble of absolute secrecy. A bubble easily popped by a single careless mistake. Claudio suggested an interesting exercise for our second day meeting in Berlin, a whack at low-hanging fruit. He pulled from his bag an unused USB stick, still in its packaging, and helped me to safely download a backup of the entirety of my digital contacts file from my personal cell phone. Then Claudio plugged the untainted USB stick into the secure laptop computer he was using to access the list, and ran an automated program that matched cell phone numbers for my contacts file with cell phone numbers in the data. The first to come up a match was for an official in Turkey's foreign ministry. I had his number because I had requested an interview with him while working on a story about secret arms transfers between the Turkish Secret Service and jihadist groups in northern Syria. The next match to come up was the phone number of Khadija Ismailova, who was the most famous and fearless investigative reporter in Azerbaijan. I knew her well. Khadija had been reporting on the financial corruption of Azeri President Ilham Aliyev for more than 15 years. The 44-year-old Ismailova had won multiple international press awards for her journalism. She had also earned the wrath of Aliyev and his secret police. Khadija had been harassed, blackmailed, and imprisoned by the Aliyev government. She was at that precise moment living under house arrest in Baku. She had been under almost constant physical surveillance for years. I had actually seen some of the spooks on Khadija Watch, beefy guys with bushy mustaches and ill-fitting trench coats. when I was on a reporting trip in Azerbaijan back in 2014. I was on the lookout for them because the first thing Khadija did when we met was alert me to Aliyev's iron dome of surveillance. Anybody who had been seen in her company, Khadija explained, would likely be spied on. "Don't do anything in your hotel room you wouldn't want to see published," she told me. She wasn't joking. I had two separate numbers for Khadija, but I had always been careful to only call or text her special secret number, the one I identified as Khadija Safe, in my contacts file. Turns out that the number in the leaked data, the number selected for targeting by the Azeri government, was Khadija Safe. The possibility that Khadija was still under surveillance was no real surprise. The possibility that she was being stalked by Pegasus was. NSO was reported to have licensed its spyware system to more than 40 countries, but Azerbaijan had never been on anybody's list. If NSO had sold licenses to cyber surveillance weapons to government agencies in Azerbaijan, a country whose annual record of civil liberties violations, political repression, and outright torture put it consistently near the top 10 of bad actors alongside China, North Korea, Somalia, and Syria, there was no telling how far and wide Pegasus had flown. That was a chilling thought, because in the short history of the cyber weapons for sale industry, surveillance was only the beginning of the problem. Where cyber surveillance was in wide use, serious casualties often followed. I had first become aware of this industry back in the summer of 2011 when two Wall Street Journal reporters had stumbled into a warren of computers in Tripoli a week after rebels had deposed the murderous Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi. The office turned out to be the hub of a massive cyber monitoring program. The recently abandoned room, the journal reporters wrote in their initial story, is lined with posters and English language training manuals stamped with the name AMSIS, a unit of French technology firm Bull SA, which installed the monitoring center. Turns out the French company, with the blessing of the French government, had sold Gaddafi an internet surveillance system that allowed his agents to monitor the emails, chats, and messages of anybody in Libya. The Gaddafi regime was able to identify and track the dictator's many political opponents almost at will. Whereas many internet interception systems carry out basic filtering on IP addresses and extract only those communications from the global flow, lawful interception, read an AMSIS-produced poster hanging in the office in Tripoli, Eagle Interception System analyzes and stores all the communications from the monitored link. Massive interception. Libyan security tactics didn't stop at surveillance. Being caught entering a chat room filled with critics of Gaddafi could have serious consequences, starting with arrest and questioning. According to the testimony of several detainees in a French court in 2013, Gaddafi's interrogators were able to quote back to them, verbatim, their emails, SMS exchanges, Facebook threads, chat room conversations, even private phone conversations. The security agents usually demanded from their captives the identities behind the various usernames they had been communicating with online or on the phone. If threats, beatings, electric shock, and other torture weren't enough to convince the detainees to reveal the names of otherwise anonymous comrades, Gaddafi's agents would ship them off to prison. Threats and beatings continued there, along with brief field trips to a courtyard to witness the executions of other prisoners. When these revelations started to come out in France, Bull SA made the prudent business move. They simply offloaded the technology that ran the Eagle system to another French company, Nexa Technologies, which continued to make it available on the open market. The Egyptian president, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, who seized power following the chaos of the Arab Spring, became one of the French cyberweapons' most enthusiastic end users. The surveillance system was reported to be a $12 million gift from al-Sisi's friends in the United Arab Emirates. The grave human rights violations committed to this day by the various branches of the Egyptian security services include arbitrary mass arrests, with the incarceration of at least 60,000 political prisoners since 2013, extrajudicial executions and forced disappearances, and the systematic use of torture. The Paris-based International Federation for Human Rights had noted in a recent report, Egypt, a repression made in France. This modus operandi of the security forces, aimed at eliminating all possibility of dissent, has become everyday reality for all Egyptians, and it specifically targets political opponents and civil society. Members of political parties, the Muslim Brotherhood, and their supporters, activists in revolutionary movements and of all stripes, human rights defenders, lawyers, journalists, writers, researchers, in addition to LGBTQ people or those perceived as such. The Bull-Emesis-Nexa axis was hardly alone in selling spyware systems to questionable regimes. Regimes that had nevertheless been designated by France as a bulwark against Islamic fundamentalism, according to the report. The enormous increase of arms sales beginning in 2013 and al-Sisi's arrival in power in Egypt in 2014 have proven profitable for at least 8 French companies that have sold equipment, both conventional weapons and surveillance equipment, to Egypt. By 2020, cyber surveillance weapons had become an international growth sector, with dozens of countries engaging in active cyber surveillance measures, almost all of them customers of private corporations who were happy to tailor the systems to their clients' needs and wants, so long as the price was right. The leading spyware technology companies had, by 2020, adjusted their focus from personal computers to cell phones, with the NSO group right out front. The consequences had been predictable. Security researchers first found evidence of a cell phone infected with NSO's Pegasus in 2016, in an iPhone owned by a human rights activist in the United Arab Emirates. But that revelation proved no great boon to the victim, Ahmed Mansour. In the aftermath of the report, Mansour lost his job, his passport, his car, his savings, and his freedom to the UAE security forces. He was beaten by unknown assailants twice in a single week. While Claudio, Danica, Sandrine, and I sat in a comfortable flat in Berlin matching my contacts to numbers on the list, Mansour was serving a 10-year prison term for threatening the unity of the state and damaging the status and prestige of the UAE and its symbols. He was reportedly being kept in solitary confinement and sporadically subjected to torture. Mansour's wife, Nadia, Reuters had reported in early 2019, lived in social isolation in Abu Dhabi. Neighbors are avoiding her out of fear security forces are watching. The evidence already out there made things clear. Pegasus and other cyber surveillance systems had become favorite toys of some of the most vicious leaders in the world, men who would not hesitate to destroy the lives of anybody who crossed them. We were contemplating crossing them in a very big way. When Claudio's automated matching program finished its work on my files, we went through the same exercise with Sandrine's. She had spent much of her early career in journalism covering politics, so her contact list was different from mine, which turned out to be helpful that day. A few French political figures in her contacts were also on the list of potential Pegasus targets. Then came the match that really jolted us. Among several Mexican journalists in the data was Jorge Carrasco, the crucial lead partner in our current project. Jorge's phone had likely been targeted by somebody in Mexican law enforcement or the Mexican military. But Pegasus was like loose nukes, gettable for the right amount of money. So it was also possible he was being watched by one or more of the corrupt and dangerous Mexican officials we were secretly investigating. Whoever had done the targeting might also be able to track us and our team and all the other collaborators on the cartel project through Jorge. We asked Claudio if Jorge should switch out his phone, and he said that was probably a good idea, but unlikely to solve the problem. NSO's customers could infect a new iPhone just as easily. Sandrine contacted a colleague of Jorge's in Mexico right away and asked him to get a message to him. Jorge needed to replace his phone, and he needed to get off and stay off the cartel project signal loop immediately. We could not tell Jorge exactly why this was necessary, but he had to trust us. We would be in touch as soon as we had a new and secure way to communicate. When Sandrine and I parted from Claudio and Danica and started preparing for the long trip back home, we were left with two big questions. How in the world could we do this story? And how could we not?